Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello and welcome to another Bunker Daily with me, Andrew Harrison. We live in a selfish world. Everything will be so much better if voters weren't so wedded to their own self-interest, and selfishness is overwhelmingly dangerous to stability and prosperity. These things are obvious if you're anywhere on the progressive spectrum, from the centre-left to the full-on socialist. But progressives are constantly perplexed that marginalised people and the working classes insist on voting against what is, on paper, their own self-interest, electing conservatives, privatisers and wealthy leaders over and over again. And meanwhile, those self-same progressives often support policies that benefit younger, wealthier, more educated people like themselves, from free tuition fees to diversity policies to internationalism and public sector investment. So what is self-interest really? Do we really understand it in others and in ourselves? Thomas Prosser is a reader in European social policy at Cardiff University, and he's just published What's in It for Me? Self-Interest and Political Difference, in which he asks why we hold the political views we do and whether, by better understanding self-interest, we can harness it and use it. Hello, Thomas. How are you doing?
Hi. Yeah, I'm great. Thanks. Thanks for having me on. I hope your listeners are well at this difficult time.
Yes. Well, I think we called the podcast The Bunker and then found that literally the entire country was locked in a bunker. So it's kind of all our fault in a lot of ways. We were acting in our own self-interest. It's a very enjoyable and an admirably non-hysterical book. At one point, you called victimization of minorities disagreeable, which is absolutely right. It is disagreeable. And you ask straight up questions like, are conservative bastards? And is social democracy finished?
You've got to catch people's eyes with the chapter headings. That's what my publisher says anyway.
So for a lot of listeners, self-interest is the original sin of Thatcherite politics and Peter Mandelson's famous quote about being very relaxed about people making a lot of money as long as they pay their taxes only compounded it. What made you want to write about self-interest and go deeper into it than perhaps those surface ideas?
Well, I think it's a really interesting topic because all human beings are self-interested. We tend to be self-interested. Of course, there's more to it than that. But the tendency is also for us to be self-interested. And I thought it would be really interesting to look at how this comes through in our politics. I've been very interested and I've written a lot about the Brexit divisions and the culture war over the last 4 or 5 years. And I think self-interest is a really interesting way to look at this topic, but because if you approach political division with the mindset that we're all self-interested, it really helps take the sting out of politics. If you reflect on your own self-interest, you become more reflective, you become more humble. If you reflect upon the self-interest of opponents, you really recognise the humanity in them. And I think that conservatives are obviously very good at acknowledging self-interest. That's not a surprise to anyone. But I'm not sure that progressives are so good at this. And what I argue in the book is that self-interest is inherent to progressive positions. Of course, progressives are also altruistic. All humans are a combination of self-interested and altruistic. But there's still self-interest in progressive positions. And if people acknowledge that, I think our political culture would be more civilised.
You just mentioned Brexit, and Brexit is the test case and the one that is very very alive, certainly on a kind of a Remainery podcast like ours. It was the test case with the majority voting against what on paper was their economic self-interest. And it wasn't just poor and marginalised people whose jobs would be threatened by this, but also, you know, wealthy conservatives. I mean, what did the Brexit episode teach us about what self-interest actually is?
Well, I think on the one hand, it's very important to acknowledge that self-interest is not just about economics. There are cultural aspects to it. I was actually a Remain campaigner in Wales during this 2016 campaign. And a mistake we made was we went on about economics the whole time. Culturally conservative views, they provide things like stability and certainty in a globalized world. There was a very interesting thing is that low-income and education voters across the world are often culturally conservative, and those values really provide fixed reference points. So you can say on the one hand that Brexit was in the self-interest of poorer, less educated voters in Britain from that point of view. You can also think about it from a different point of view. There's a very interesting concept in the literature called values rationality. What this theory concerns is that although certain values, it concerns that certain values might be in the broad interest of certain groups. So you could argue that leaving the European Union is in the wider interest of low-income demographics and poorly educated demographics. But according to the logic of the values, they're willing to endorse short-term pain in pursuit of that. But of course, it's a very difficult topic. As I just said, I was a Remain campaigner and I was bemused by many of the attitudes I encountered. It's also worth remembering that there is survey evidence which showed that poor Leave voters were more worried about a no deal outcome than richer Leave voters. So there was such an effect. But of course, there were multiple influences on this process. And as I said, self-interest is not solely economic.
It's also kind of a double-edged sword in the ongoing, the broadest political debate, which now with the advent of social media, we're probably in a longer and more continual and wider political debate than we ever really have been. And there has to be an assumption everywhere that the people on the other side are operating from the worst motivation, and that worst motivation is always self-interest. So Leavers have to be racist and thick, and Remainers have to be complacent middle-class people, you know, who all shop from Waitrose and have it delivered to their home in the Dordogne. This idea that my own self-interests are pure, but the other sides are always base and always suspect.
Yeah. I think that's a real shame. This was one of the reasons I wanted to write this book. I think we're all human, you know, and humans, their interests are mixed. On the one hand, we can obviously be selfish and self-interested. We can be altruistic, though, as well. And I think what I try and do in the book is I try and show that mix of our characters. I think that both positions are legitimate and are broadly consistent with the self-interest of those who voted for them. Of course, the stereotypes about Remainers being elitists are ridiculous, and them shopping at Waitrose and so on and so forth. But, openness associated with European integration is associated with the self-interest of liberals. Things like freedom of movement allow them to maximise returns on labour markets. Liberals are very relaxed about cultural openness. Whereas with Leavers, it's the opposite. There's a greater desire for certainty in a changing world. And, you know, I don't agree with the Leave position, but I think it's a legitimate position for such people to take.
You do mention in the book that your own mother-in-law is a small farmer in Poland, and she's a big fan of Poland's Law and Justice Party and Donald Trump. So you must have interesting conversations on the family Zoom over Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Well, so sorry, she's not a supporter of Trump.
She's an admirer.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, first of all, I love my mother-in-law dearly, and I did get permission to write about her in the book. I think it's fair to say if she were in the US, she would be a Trump fan, but she's not in the US. She left school at a very young age. She lives in the countryside. She's also older. You know, she doesn't speak any English, obviously. I speak Polish. And it's fascinating going there, because what you notice is the sort of mix of Catholic and nationalistic value satisfies the needs of such groups. And peace are very redistributive as well. They're one of the most redistributive parties in Europe. It's extremely interesting when I go there just to immerse myself in the sort of the world of the Polish countryside. We go to the church and everything. And what I would say is I certainly don't agree with Jarosław Kaczynski. I think he's nuts. They really are a very ugly party piece. They're much uglier. Well, maybe not much uglier, but uglier than UKIP or the Brexit Party, in my opinion. I think the key thing is I don't think that such culturally conservative attitudes are pathological. Lots of liberals think that such attitudes are pathological. I think they're legitimate. I don't agree with them, but I think they're legitimate.
Well, one of the interesting things in the chapter on national populism, with the, as you say, provocative title, "Are Brexiters Stupid?" And of course, you don't go on to say that they are, you go into it a lot deeper than that. But you do identify a strong strain of altruism in national populists for things like Help for Heroes. I think you say something along the lines of liberal altruism tends to be obviously in the service of liberal causes, but national populist altruism is associated with values such as patriotism. Have middle-class liberals like me, have we missed a trick in identifying that strain of altruism within populism and finding a way to kind of channel it, turn it in a positive direction rather than the, you know, the we look after our own sort of insular idea of altruism?
Well, I think Help for Heroes is a very good example. As are all charitable causes. Well, pretty much every charitable cause is admirable, but obviously, people tend to pick causes which are closer to their own hearts. And in low income education communities, it's things like helping injured soldiers, and of course it's admirable. But I think that There is a bit of a tendency in liberal circles to, you know, just smile and dismiss such charity and altruism. I agree it's unfortunate, but I guess you know we all champion, if you like, causes which are close to our hearts. You can't be too crude about this. You know, there are many liberals or many conservatives. There are rich conservatives who give to homeless charities. There are poor liberals or rich liberals or whatever who help the homeless or help the blind or whatever. So it's certainly not a direct link. There's a very interesting study, actually, by two academics, Chris Prosser and John Mellon.
Prosser? Hang on a minute.
Yeah, no, he's actually no relation. Oddly enough, I do actually work with him. I include their study in my book, but because it really shows you know the sort of how murky this topic is. What they find is that actually liberals, whether they're rich or poor, tend to favour redistribution of wealth. Now, for cultural conservatives, so national populists or whatever, it's more complicated. That depends on whether they're rich or poor themselves. So for poorer national populists or Brexit supporters, they might support redistribution because there's something in it for them. But richer national populists like Farage or Rees-Mogg tend not to because they tend to think in more egotistical terms. Whereas for liberals, it's different. There is support redistribution across income decile. So that merely shows how complicated this all is. I mean, I think it's very important to look at this from all sides of the picture. I think that people's interests are mixed, and it's really unfortunate in over the last 5 years that our political culture has developed in a way where we're very crude about the motivations of others. It's not healthy.
Well, just finally, before we wrap up, the pandemic has kind of upended ideas of what your actual self-interest is. You know, being crude about it, a big pay packet and a loft in the middle of a major city is suddenly a lot less important than a stable NHS or a functioning community. Do you think that, I mean, over the past year, we've heard endless talk about, is this going to be a 1926? Is this going to be a 1945? Is it going to change the political culture of the country? Do you think it will change our idea of what self-interest is and how it motivates our politics?
I finished writing this book right when the pandemic hit, and I confess that I didn't really write the book with this issue in mind. I think also politics associated with COVID-19 has really been all been about, well, not all about, but the politics has been quite technocratic. So issues of how you manage things best, obviously, the politics of competence has become more and more important. And Boris Johnson, I think as you'll appreciate, it doesn't seem to be particularly adept here. But anyway, I think that the links with self-interest are less obvious. What has interested me, though, are the different attitudes of different voters, of low-education voters and high-education voters. I think I'm right in saying, I need to check it with data, but I think I'm right in saying low-education voters show less support for the lockdown measures, and higher education voters show greater support. And I would have thought that low education voters are equally exposed to the dangers of contracting COVID-19. Although, on the other hand, I'm kind of thinking out loud here, it may be that they need to get back to work more quickly. It's complicated. It's all complicated. But I do try and get to the bottom of this this fascinating topic in my book.
Well, the standout line for me was awareness of self-interest makes us more tolerant. There's a lot to chew on in that, I think, that the idea that maybe the person you're having a massive row with on Twitter might not be evil incarnate. It's a radical thought. Thomas Prosser, thanks for joining us in the bunker. It's been great talking to you.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
What's in it for me? Self-interest and political difference is published on Tuesday, 12th of January by Manchester University Press. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of The Bunker. I'm doing a lot of them this week, so you may be sick of the sound of my voice. Sorry about that, but don't forget to subscribe, and some of the other regulars will be along soon. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
The Bunker Daily was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronievich. Audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.